This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Ewan McElraith from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. I'm Mark Stephen. We build the Scotland Outdoors Podcast out of the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which this week was a bit of an adventure. We had a red weather warning, so getting in was a lot of fun. The conditions were still pretty wild when we started the programme. And understandably, we were kind of gravitating towards the warmth and the heat and just the general comfort of fire.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland.
Last night we had a red weather warning. And to be honest, I can't remember the last time there was a red weather warning in Aberdeenshire. Basically, it's when there's a threat to human life. And we went out to do the horses at 9 o'clock last night, and I cannot remember the last time I was frightened of the wind. We lost two trees down, about three trees are broken in half. The roads this morning are covered in stuff. If you're out and about, take great care. And if you're anywhere near trees, it may not have come down all the way. So please, please be careful. I'm Mark Stephen, standing here in the car park in Beechgrove in Aberdeen, about 40 miles away, sheltering in rural Bamshire, Mr. Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, a pretty wild night. No power, no internet, no roof on the hut, no roof on the garage, no way out because there's trees everywhere. And that point you were making about the branch might not have come down, there was one point I was out last night kind of feeling sorry for myself and suddenly realised as a big branch came hurtling down, this is downright dangerous. Yeah. Get out of here. So, yeah, I'm just waiting for daylight to see how bad it is, but reiterate that point, take care, because there's still trees coming down, there's still big branches hanging off. I'd never experienced anything like that. As you said, that's the first time I felt really frightened by a wind because it was really thumping up against you.
Yeah, well, the wind has certainly dropped. It's snowing here in the car park at the moment, but it is still windy. I spotted last night, Braemar Mountain Rescue Team put something up basically saying they'd taken a screenshot of the Met Office. Bray Riach in Aberdeenshire, they reckon at 9 o'clock this morning it's going to be -9. But with wind chill, that'll bring it down. It's -22. And I've heard people already saying, don't, please just don't go out this weekend up into the hills. It's too dodgy, OK?
Yeah, and broadcasting for the first time, actually, by torchlight and candlelight, which is novel.
That's romantic, isn't it? Anyway, you can get in touch with us this morning. We like hearing about what you're up to today. Let us know if you've got things like, have you got power? How did you do? I mean, last night, did you see the evening in through candlelight? What time did you go to bed? All the usual stuff. It's amazing how early you can go to bed when you've got no television.
Yeah, getting in touch. I actually got a big log fire on, and there's a new edition on BBC Sounds of the Battersea Poltergeist.
Ah.
And so listen to ghost stories by firelight last night. It's fascinating stuff. And the one thing that doesn't change, the mystery bird is flying past Aberdeen at 95 miles an hour at the moment. Have a listen to this and see if you know what it is. I wouldn't have got this one. That's, it sounds like a complete made-up bird, but they are here now, especially on the East Coast and the Central Belt. Any ideas, email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk if you've got power.
Scotland is rightly proud of its access legislation, the Land Reform Act Scotland 2003. Enshrined the right of responsible access, meaning that here we've got access to most land for recreational and indeed some other purposes.
Yeah, and on the whole, the Act has been respected by landowners. But what happens when it's challenged? Well, Ramblers Scotland has just embarked on a landmark challenge to, against an owner's attempts to permanently stop walkers using a section of a path on his West Highland estate. I spoke to Brendan Paddy, he's the director for Ramblers Scotland, and he explained the background.
We're talking about the Ardnamurchan estate on the Ardnamurchan Peninsula, and it's near the town of Glenborrowdale. And the particular path that's in dispute at the moment is one that runs through what's now a woodyard. But that path has been there 100 plus years. It used to be, we believe, a drove road. And so it's a claimed right of access, and it takes you up to one of the neighbouring villages, but also up into the hills north of Glenborrowdale.
It's a fantastic walk. It's spectacular scenery.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Ardnamurchan Peninsula is rugged, beautiful, everything you would want on a walk. But one of the things about it is because it's so rugged, actually, even if you're quite happy going off path, this is one of those places where actually the path's your friend and you might need them.
Now, there's been a bit of history on this estate with access being limited.
So sadly, this is not the first time that we've heard complaints by people who are having their rights of access disrupted on this estate. So there are a number of examples where deer gates have been locked, and particularly, obviously, if you have mobility issues, and God help you if you have a bike, you're going to have some real difficulties getting over a locked deer gate. The reports do vary, but the locals have been saying for a number of years that there have been access issues on this estate, so this is not his first rodeo.
This came to a head a wee while ago, which resulted in the police being called. Talk me through that.
So this is a really unfortunate incident where two of our members, who are quite elderly, were walking through the area that's in dispute, the woodyard, as they had done for many, many years, because this is a very well-established path, and it ended with the police being called and the police reporting them to the Procurator Fiscal for aggravated trespass. Now, you might remember, this came out of a moral panic in the 90s when everyone was losing their minds about hunt saboteurs and outdoor raves. So the idea that a couple of people out for a peaceful stroll were going to be prosecuted under that, from our point of view, was really unprecedented. We'd never seen anything like it, and we were very pleased when the Procurator Fiscal decided not to proceed.
Because my understanding of aggravated trespass is that you're disrupting operations, possibly deliberately.
So the usual story in Scotland with any kind of trespass really is, even if you do not have a legal right to be on somebody's land, you are not likely to get into difficulties for trespass unless you are doing something disruptive or causing damage. And that clearly was not the case in this instance.
That was thrown out by the fiscal. The situation now, as far as I understand it, is the landowner has applied to restrict access on a certain part of that, Section 28.
Yeah, so the way this works under the Land Reform Act Scotland 2003 is anyone can apply for a Section 28, which is basically a declaration from the court that Land Reform Act rights apply or do not apply on a particular piece of land. And so what the landowner has done here is gone to court and say, I want you, the sheriff, to issue a piece of paper saying that there is no right of access under the Land Reform Act across my woodyard.
Regardless of the legal side of it, it seems sensible. If you've got an active woodyard with tractors, with JCBs, cutting equipment, that from a safety point of view, you wouldn't want the public walking through that.
So generally, under the Land Reform Act, you wouldn't necessarily expect to have access through a working yard. Now, this is a little bit special because, firstly, this is a claimed right of way. So that actually may take precedence. But even under the Land Reform Act, there are circumstances in which you do have rights across a working yard, so long as you take them with care, which is often possible. But the way this is normally resolved is if a landowner has a particular concern with health and safety, which is the issue being raised by the landowner here, then they simply provide a short detour around the edge of that working area. Now, if that were to be offered, and that's something that local people have raised with the landowner, then I think they would accept that, and I think probably probably we would too, so long as it was a reasonably sensible short diversion. But unfortunately, that hasn't been offered, and the alternatives which are being suggested, which are being presented as these natural compromises, are actually not on the land of the landowner. Sometimes they're quite big diversions, and sometimes they're taking you onto land which is heavily vegetated, extremely steep, and completely pathless.
There's a suggestion that you're just being bloody-minded about it. You know, this is a binary choice, and you want access anywhere you want to go.
So there's always room for compromise in terms of the way that access is applied. Most walkers are very sensible people, the ramblers amongst them, and we're really willing to be flexible where there's a need to be so. But what I would say about this is the logical compromise here would be a very short diversion around the perimeter of the woodyard. And it's notable that that does not seem to be on the table.
Is there a dangerous precedent here for other estates, for other access? Because there's a potential to drive a coach and horses through the access legislation.
I think if every landowner who decided that they did not want people on a particular piece of land, whether that be a working yard or some other piece of land that they regarded as being exclusively theirs, then I think you could see a really difficult situation emerge, because neither the ramblers nor local authorities are in a position to challenge this every single time it comes up. We're having to go to the public and ask them to support our legal case, because we simply do not have the deep pockets that some landowners do in order to pay for the kinds of legal action that are necessary to protect land rights. We are extremely pleased that in this instance, the Highlands and Islands Council have stepped up and are standing alongside us in court saying this is not just a right of way, but also an area where land rights apply and has been for over 100 years. So that's the good news. The difficult news about this is councils are very reluctant to engage in these kinds of legal actions because they're expensive, they're extremely time-consuming, and the outcomes are obviously uncertain, as with any court action. So I think it would be extremely helpful if the government were to look at the way that the Land Reform Act is functioning with a view to giving councils more powers where they can't simply find themselves in court when they make a simple administrative decision to enforce the law.
And ironically, the Highland Council were thinking of making this track, part of its core path network.
So because of the very long-running disputes on the estate, the council had taken the view that the simplest way to resolve finally and forever the issues about access across this piece of land was to designate it as a core path, which would put beyond question people's right of access here. And it is after that that the landowner has raised this case seeking a court declaration to say that access rights do not apply.
So when's your day in court?
So we're back in court in February, but we expect that really to be just the very beginning of the process. So, you know, quite apart from the costs, it's very slow to actually get rights of access restored in this way by going through court.
Brendan Paddy there, Director of Ramblers Scotland. And we've also been able to speak to Donald Houston, who's the Director of Ardna Murchan Estate, the estate in question.
Yeah, I spoke to him yesterday to get his side of the story and his reaction to the impending court hearing.
I'm totally baffled and dumbfounded by it. The Land Reform Act makes provision for excluding farmyards and working areas from the right of responsible access. And this yard's been in operation now for over 50 years. Because of a couple of incidences, and goodness knows why they happened, it became necessary and expedient to actually get a declarator in the court to say that it's a farmyard, and that's all that we're after, is the sheriff to say, yep, you're right, it's a farmyard.
There's been accusations that the gates, the access, the path that's been a path that's been used for hundreds of years, are regularly locked. What's your response to that?
The gates to the shed area have been locked. I mean, I can only speak for the last 25, 30 years. But there's a guy that used to live just down the hill, and he was brought up there. And my predecessors locked the gate. Their predecessors locked the gates. Indeed, one of them had barbed wire on it. So those gates have been locked since almost the beginning of time. So if I'm going through a gate with, you know, driving through, and I've got to go up the hill to check on sheep or cattle or whatever I'm doing, I'll leave the gate open. So it's not locked 24-7, because you know, I can't be bothered getting out of my vehicle and locking it every time I go through. But generally, and at night and weekends and when there isn't regular traffic, it's been locked for over 30 years.
What about the situation where two people were charged with aggravated trespass, which was subsequently rejected by the Procurator Fiscal? What happened there?
My understanding is the Fiscal didn't reject it, but didn't take it forward on the basis that there was no corroboration. So what it is the working yard there, we've got tractors and trailers, we've got telehandlers, forklift trucks, we've got wood chippers, tankers, going in and out of there, you know, wood lorries with 40 tons of timber on them, going in and out of there on a regular basis. And we, speaking with the access officer and the two individuals at a meeting that is in fact minuted, and we've recently found the minutes of this that was signed off by everyone, the access officer said that he couldn't recommend anyone taking access at the moment because of health and safety reasons. And we said, we are denying access. He doesn't want the yard to be there. He wants it to go. But he said, at the moment, for health and safety reasons, you shouldn't be taking access. And because of the advice we've had from the health and safety people, we cannot continue to work if there are people wandering around the yard. It's fundamentally dangerous. The people that were at the yard that came through, they knew that we would have to stop work. But they still came through. Rather than take any of the alternative routes that go around the yards, we formally put forward four alternatives. And I'm sure with a bit of creativity and a little bit of investigation, we could find half a dozen more accesses. We are closing off 100 yards because it happens to go right through the middle of the yard.
Nobody's going to want to walk through a working wood yard. As you said, it's a dangerous place. But surely it's possible to put a path that is safe and doesn't deny access.
Yes, and there are. There are alternatives. They're there. The access track that the Highland Council are wanting to use and the Ramblers Association are talking about, the access from the public road to the yard can be taken in one of two ways. One is up through the garden grounds of Glenboroughdale Castle, which is a listed garden. And we've got confirmation from the Rights of Way and Access Society that that's not a public right of way. People can't just wander through the grounds of Glenboroughdale Castle. The gate on that to the public road has been locked for years. The other access track, the one that Highland Council are pushing for people to have the right to use, was actually only built in 2012 or 11. Because we didn't want to continue to take access through Glenboroughdale Castle grounds, we built a new track. And it's that track that people now want to use on a regular basis. And we're saying, sorry, guys, no, it's dangerous.
It just seems that there's a whole stooshy here that could be solved relatively easy by getting together and saying, where's a safe non-invasive route to allow people to go on this path in a fantastic part of the country that they've enjoyed for hundreds of years. It doesn't seem unsolvable.
Absolutely, and we've tried dozens of times to engage with the access officer of Highland Council. When they put in the core path application, we spoke to everyone locally and we said, listen, guys, we need a bit of help here. We got somewhere approaching 200 signatories of people who genuinely live here, supporting our position that it's been a working yard for many, many years. The new road was only put in 2011, and there are alternatives all the way up there, all the way down, up and down the road. No issues at all.
There's a solution here that maybe we all need to get together and talk to each other and potentially save tens, if not hundreds of thousands of pounds in legal fees to come to an amicable agreement. It seems like it's fixable.
It is. What came out in court the other day, Ramblers Association have got an annual income of last year of £11.8 million. And they are trying to fight me. People have got this perception of landowners in Scotland. You know, I'm a working farmer. I farm. It just happens to be a fairly big piece of ground, but that's only because it doesn't sustain enough animals on a small bit. you know, to make it viable, it's got to be a fair chunk of size. But it's a lot of bare hill with absolutely nothing on it, very picturesque though it may be. We can only be sustainable through tourism. So we converted a bunch of disused farmhouses and goodness knows what. We rely on tourists and visitors. We want them to access the hill. We're on record for doing that for 25 years. We want people here. We don't want to deter them, and we don't want to close off anything that we don't have to for their safety and our safety.
Donald Houston there, Director of Arden American Estate. You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. Coming up, a lost railway in a remote estate. Ewan attempts his first long-distance journey in his wee electric car. And just how bad for the environment is our fire pit, sitting right here in front of me, here in the car park in Beechgrove. We're joined live by somebody who can actually explain.
See, the other thing about an electric car I thought about this morning, is what happens when you have a power cut across the country?
Well, that's you. You have to stay at home.
Simple yeah, but if, you, just, you know, if you're on the other side of the country and you get power cuts, just an interesting one. Anyway, back to the mystery bird. And what's disappointing is somebody's got this correct already,
oh, no.
And I've no idea how. Have a listen and see if you can identify it.
It's a bonny song. We've
it's
got some
a
guess-
lovely song.
It's a lovely song. We've got some incorrect guesses in already. Keith heading home from the night shift said, is it a white throat? No, but very close. Marion from Premney, listening in Power Cut Kings Wells, getting ready to go back to Curl Aberdeen for the Scottish Junior Championships. Is it a waxwing? Nope. Wendy from Battle Montrose, field fair? Nope. Ruth Murray, field fair? Nope. No power since 4 p.m, says Ruth. Big branches down from the Granny Pines. Some of the gusts were really frightening, you're telling me. Graham and Les Windy Denny, well done, Ewan, for keeping the broadcast going in severe circumstances. Is it a waxwing? And Ross Atenal thought it might be a waxwing too.
They're on the right path, aren't they? They're getting... They're almost circling it so early in the morning. How can people know what that is at this time of the morning in the pitch dark? Get in touch if you think you know what that is. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. And the wind's back up again. I can hear it gusting.
Well, it's not. It's died here in Aberdeen, so 40 miles away. But then again, you seem to be sort of leading the charge with this. Last week, I was down at the Spittle of Glen Shee with Helen recording some interviews relating to, a really staggeringly large work of public art, which is high up in the hill there. It's called The Awakening. We'll bring it to you in the next couple of weeks. Whilst we were there, knowing our passion for all things railway related, we took a hint, a turn up to the Dalmunsie Castle Hotel, where there's a disused railway. Now, the hotel sits nestled in amongst the hills. It is a really, really unlikely setting for such a construction. So I asked Vary Duncan, general manager at the hotel, just to give me a bit of background to the estate and the railway.
Most recently, it's been bought by Sir Henry Angst, who actually lives just down the road at Bridge of Calais. So it's run as a traditional shooting estate, but also the farmland is worked as well. We've got an 18-bedroom hotel and then 7 holiday cottages on the estate as well. So the garages used to be the engine house. So there were 2 tracks that came into the garages here. One came down this side here to collect guests, and then the other one came round this side of the building so that it could drop any deer that they'd shot at the game larder.
Can you see any of the railway still? Where was it?
You can still see remnants of the railway. So it went from the hotel here 2.5 miles out onto the hill. Uh-huh. One of the reasons they built it was to take guests out onto the hill so that they could go shooting.
Lazy guests.
Very lazy guests. And then also to bring deer back. It's quite a trek from here before you start to incline onto the hill. So it was also to give the ponies a break so that they didn't have to carry the deer all the way back. And the other reason that they were building it was so that they could bring stone back to then build an extension onto the hotel. So as they built the railway, as they took out more sleepers and more rails, they would then bring back stone that they had quarried on the hill.
I have to say, I would have thought you're going to run a railway anywhere. From the main road up to the hotel would be a good idea because it's miles to get up to the hotel.
It would be. Well, it's a very similar distance. So the railway ran from here directly through this tree line and then out onto the hill. You can see there's a direct sort of path through the trees. There are some sleepers and also some rails at the end of the forestry, though. It was actually on a switchback, so went out and then came back on itself to then manage the incline. I'm not sure exactly what sort of gradient it would have been, though. They were actually repurposed locomotives from the First World War. They were refurbished and then put out onto the line, all diesel-powered engines. There was a pump just at the back of the larder there.
Was there a particular reason that, you know, somebody looked at the problem here and thought, I know, a railway, because it's unusual?
It is unusual. They were built by Sir Archibald Berkmar, and I know that he'd had some experience of railways when he worked in India. He was in the jute industry in India, and they used them there. He also had visited an estate at Gledick, and they had a very similar setup, a lot shorter, but they had a similar setup for taking guests out onto the hill, and he'd admired that and thought, I'd quite like one of those.
I think if you had the means and the wherewithal to have your own railway, it'd be quite a sort of shallow spirit that wouldn't go for it. I know, I'll have trains that work and go and everything, what have you. And how long did it run for?
So it ran from 1920 right up until 1978. The main reason that they stopped using it is that it was then seen that as a commercial railway as opposed to a private railway. So there would have been lots of fees and sort of health and safety legislations that would have come into force if they'd have carried on using it. So that was the main reason that they stopped using it.
You've got a book with you here, The Domangii Railway, which is fabulous because it's two guys in what look like tweed suits, knickerbockers, one of them's wearing, that's possibly the keeper. And then there's a guy having a fag in a kilt, and it actually says Domangii on the carriage. It's not big, it wasn't a huge gauge, obviously.
It wasn't, no, it was a very narrow gauge railway. They have actually taken the remaining locomotive and the two carriages to Alan Keefe's for restoration, and they've actually extended the gauge so that it's now a 2-foot gauge, so that they can actually run it on the lines that they've got at their yard. They used wooden sleepers for part of the railway, and then they actually poured and cast their own concrete sleepers.
And there's a zigzag climb.
Zigzag climb, and then this is Glenlochsy Lodge, which is the shooting lodge that's out on the hill.
That's seen better days.
It has, unfortunately. It's pretty derelict now. I think that's actually looking quite good there.
Yeah.
The roof's completely gone now.
Yeah.
This picture here, that's Sir Archibald Berkmar in the middle there on the horse.
So you've got all the keepers and the two guys on, you know, what look like... Well, his horse, Archibald's horse, actually looks quality. The other guy's horse looks like it's just lost the plough somewhere.
It does. It looks a bit sad.
And there it is in the snow.
That's it in the snow, yep. So that's where we're standing now. So this is where it would come into the garages here.
If I owned the estate nowadays, I would be heartbroken that I didn't still have it, because that is a unique selling point. If you could say to people, come up here, have lunch, take the train up into the glen and climb it, where else are you going to be able to do that?
Nowhere. You wouldn't be able to do that anywhere. It would definitely be a unique selling point. I don't think it's probably financially viable anymore, but it would have been fantastic in its day.
Barry Duncan of the Domangii Castle Hotel at the Spittle of Glenshee.
Fantastic railway line. I went up to the lodge there, and you're right. To reinstate that, what a tourist attraction. Do you remember we got the wee train up in Chamonix up to kind of a restaurant way up on a hill? It's the only way to get to it, apart from climbing. That would work.
No, you got the railway up to restaurant.
I
did walk. No, I was thinking actually the one that it really reminded me of is that one on the Isle of Man. You know, that's our switchback railway, so it goes right up to the top of the hill and what have you. It'd be a fantastic thing to have, but it was nice talking to Vary about, you know, sort of the sort of what's left of that railway, the remains of the day they had a railway.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I would put it back in.
Me too. coming up. We've got heaps of stuff, but we've got a couple of comments first saying, good morning, fellow storm survivors. Here in Elgin, I was awake because of the noise the wind was making through the draft strip, the appropriately named draft strip, on my front door. I spent some useful time learning choir songs and found myself just waiting for 6:30 when I could hear your dulcet and comforting tones. If you've both made it to your posts, then we can feel hopeful. Amanda. Well, my post was some effort. His post was basically out the back door, Amanda, so I don't know why you're impressed with him.
Well, it's involved a lot of working around the garden trying to find a decent signal.
Yes. trying to find a place that was actually safe to stand, where maybe might be an issue too. A tremendous amount of detritus came out of the trees. You know, and what's annoying me is I just got the garden tidied up. Everything was lovely. Just perfect. And there is just foliage all over the shop now. I'm just sitting here, you know, the wind's blowing, there's no leaves left on the trees, the fence has collapsed off to my right. And the only thing really keeping me going is the fact I've got a cup of coffee, nice and warm, and I've got the fire in front of me. And the days of that fire could well be numbered, depending on the progress of an interview we'll be doing later in the next hour.
And as you contemplate the last flame, there's still time to put your tuppence worth of Mr. Mystery Bird. Loads and loads of people getting in touch. Have a listen to this.
I would have no idea.
No, I was going to give a clue and then the producer hurtled over and said, no, we're too busy. The flame is flickering here and it's just casting shadows all over the highly technical equipment.
Yeah, well, you better get used to it because I came across this job the other day that I think would suit both of us down to the ground. Garden hermit or ornamental hermit. There were folk that were encouraged to live in purpose-built hermitages, follies, grottos or rockeries on the estates of wealthy landowners, primarily during the 18th century. You'd be encouraged to dress like a druid. I can do that. Remain permanently on site where they could be fed, cared for and consulted for advice. That is my perfect job right there.
Rent a gnome.
All right, fair enough. You get to go rent a gnome. I'll do the druid bit. Anyway, moving on swiftly, you bought a new car the other day.
Yeah, well, off the back of going to Orkney the other day, where, you know, it's electric vehicle fantastic, I thought, you know, actually, with the back of Co-op, I should do this. So I went and bought a new electric car, well, almost new electric car. And this is just a public service thing, because I really love the car. I think it's the way ahead, but there were problems. Well, this is where the adventure begins. I'm in Turriff and I'm beside the charging point. I've been to the supermarket just to top it up because tomorrow after the programme, I'm planning on going to Loch Creran to pick up some stuff from the boat. According to the manufacturers, I should have a range of 311 miles, so I should be able to get there and possibly back. Now, I know the official range bears no resemblance to reality. So I'm going to see how far I get. To make it even more difficult, I'm towing a trailer, so I'm going to get much less. Anyway, I came into town to top up before the start of the expedition, and frankly, I'm feeling sick. I plugged it back in, and it came up 60p. Fantastic. What a bargain. And then before my eyes, I felt a chill going up my spine as it rolled over from 60p to £3,000. £3,000. Now, obviously, this is a mistake, and I have high hopes that the company will scrub it off my account. But at the moment, I don't know that. I tell you, I'm feeling a bit sick. It's 7 o'clock in the morning in Fort William. Wonderful night, great beer, lovely pizzas, bracken. Well, if I'm in a moaning mode, we got to the hotel that said it was pet friendly, and then turns out that was 4 years ago. Not anymore, and no, you can't stay here. Luckily, there's a budget hotel down the road, right next to some fantastic pubs and restaurants, and they said, of course, bring your dog in here. And it was a third, fourth, a quarter of the price of the hotel I was going to stay in originally. So things looking up. Now, I've got 60 miles. Stay with me on that. 60 miles on the guessometer. And I've got about 40 miles to go, maybe about 30 miles to go. But here in Fort William, it's 30 pence per unit. But down at Ballachulish, it's only 15 pence per unit. So it's half the price, and it's just 15 miles down the road. So I'm going to go to Ballachulish and save myself a pile of cash.
I want to drive my car. I want to drive my car further and further on down the road. I want to drive my car.
My greed has been my downfall. I've arrived at Ballachulish and there is a charge point, there is a green light, but I can't connect to it. If you don't have the government card, you need a mobile phone. Top tip here, keep your mobile charged, otherwise you cannot get any electricity out of the machine. It's kind of academic because I'm not going to get anything from this one anyway. I've just spoken to the call centre and they say they can't communicate with this one, and so there's nothing they can do. In fact, they can't communicate with a whole range of charge points across the country. I just looked at the interactive map and vast swathes of Scotland are now non-charging points. I've been advised to wait, it'll probably fix itself. It's 7:30 in the morning. So I'm going to risk it. I'm going to go down to the boatyard, plug in my granny charger, and hope beyond hope that it might get fixed later in the day. With a bit of luck, I've got enough to get back to Fort William, where it's also showing the chargers are out of action. Hopefully that'll change. We're going to rock down to Electric Avenue. And then we'll
take it higher. Hey, we're going to rock. What's a granny charger?
Granny chargers, where you just a domestic plug at one end and it plugs into the car at the other. It take from empty about 30 hours.
Wow.
On a granny charger.
And how much money would you have saved had you managed to get charged up at Ballachulish?
I would have saved probably about £5, I think. Which I thought was... Yeah, it's all very easy for you to preach.
It was when you said, and then greed got the better of me, and the entire production team went, and not for the first time.
Yeah. Even if it hadn't been an adventure, what a golden opportunity for Ron to dig out his whole 70s music collection.
Yeah, and 80s in some places. Yeah.
And 80s, yeah.
Yeah, well, hear more about Ewan's epic journey, epic e-journey, later in the programme. We've had some more incorrect guesses for Mystery Birds. There's no name on this, just says, hello, Hubby George thinks it might be a field fair. Well done for both managing to broadcast this morning. It was wild on the borders, but sounds like it was crazy where you were. It was. Mary in St Andrews thought it might be a greenfinch. Alistair Nelgan says, good morning, gentlemen. See, I like that. Polite.
It's a good way to go.
Yeah. Feel fortunate because we haven't had a power outage. Strong winds and heavy rain, yes, and we'll check trees when light. Knowing the high levels of production which go into the making of out of doors, eh? Today's bird must be a storm petrel. very good.
If I thought of that.
I wish we had. John Wheeler thought it was a snow bunting. Elizabeth Thompson thought it was a snow bunting. Fiona and Paul Yu thought it might be a warbler. Richard and Mandy in Exeter, Stonechat. Andrew Barry, Waxwing, nope. Paddy in Aberdeen, Bramling. Nicky in Edinburgh, snow bunting. And Graham and Denny, snow bunting. See, people want it to be a snow bunting.
Well, but we could probably change it. Because, it's radio. You can make it anything you want.
Yeah.
it's a visitor. I did say that right at the start. So... perhaps, and you'll see them on the East Coast, you'll see them in a stretch through the central belt, and they're regular visitors.
Yeah. Anyway, last weekend, and this is rather sad, last weekend marked the 50th anniversary of the Cairngorm disaster. Five teenage school pupils and their 18-year-old guide froze to death on the Cairngorm Plateau in what remains the worst mountaineering disaster in British history. In 2018, as a part of a programme looking at the history of mountain rescue in the Northeast. You and I spoke to two of those involved, Graham MacDonald and Mario De Mayo.
Well, Graham and I were both involved in that rescue. Yeah. It was, for me, the first really big rescue I'd ever been involved in. Yeah. And that was a group... I mean, the background to this is a group of youngsters and two instructors were heading across the Cairngorm Plateau to a bothy at a place called the Fay Buoy.
Yeah.
And the Fay Buoy is a depression in the plateau which catches a lot of snow. And for some slightly bizarre reason, there was a bothy there which fairly frequently in the winter was difficult to access because of the amount of snow around it. They got caught in extremely bad weather, blizzard conditions, high winds, lots of snow. And the net result of that is that several of the youngsters perished from hypothermia. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the scale of it was such, you know, so many young people who died in what really was extraordinary circumstances in terms of weather, that it started a national debate which actually went all the way from, you know, outdoor education and outdoor training and the quality of instruction that was taking youngsters to the hills to whether there should be high-level bothies in the Cairngorms. Mm-hmm. You know, and the Fay Buoy was eventually removed because it was seen as being something that attracted people into onto the plateau in conditions where probably they would have been better not to feel the certainty, oh, there's a bothy, so if we get to that, we'll be safe.
If memory serves me right, it was five youngsters, Graham,
yeah,
and the teacher. I mean, what's your own memory of that?
My own memory is that it was absolutely dreadful weather, and it was really hard going on the hill over the course of the 2 days that we were out. But I think more than that, it's probably the one rescue that I really remember with a touch of sadness, because they were just youngsters. I mean, I myself was just in my late teens, maybe 20, I think. And really tragically, the thing that sticks with me is that one of the kids on the trip, it was actually his or her birthday, but the following week when we went back to recover the remains of their abortive camp, we actually came upon the birthday cake. Yeah. So that was rather tragic. So that's the one thing that sticks with me. It was a dreadful accident. And yet a week later, the conditions on the Cairngorm Plateau were quite benign. You know, the snow had disappeared and, you know, it was still early winter, but just very unlucky in terms of the weather on that particular day that they were out.
How did you cope with that? I mean, it must have a big impact on you. Do you all kind of help each other out there?
I mean, Graham was just a little bit older than me. I was 18 and not very experienced as a mountain rescuer. I'm not very experienced in life, to be perfectly frank, at that age. And I remember when we were making our way up Glenderry through deep snow, Graham, you'll remember it well, I've no doubt, finding it physically very, very demanding. And as we started to get little bits of information, you realised that the weather conditions were so atrocious that on the plateau itself, it must have been absolutely horrendous. And to be honest with you, at the time, I didn't think very much about it. You just sort of got on with it. But a few days later, you know, when you began to read the story that it was in the press about what had happened and all the rest of it, I found it actually quite tough. And to be honest with you, I did wonder at that point whether this was something I was prepared to get into in a big way. And back then, of course, there was no counselling. You know, nobody took you aside and said, you know, talk us through your feelings about that and all the rest of it. But the camaraderie of the team, and you know, you asked the question earlier, why do people get into it and why do people stay in Mountain Rescue Team? For me, it's because it is the camaraderie and the sort of group dynamics of working with people, sometimes in extreme conditions, where you rely very heavily on each other. And through certainly my career in mountain rescue, and I'm sure guys are the same, that as that builds up, there's a support system in there, you know, which allows you to carry on and go through all of these sorts of things and deal with these things on the hill in a way that actually allows you to do the job professionally.
Mario De Mayo and Graham MacDonald there. And you may have heard Heather Morning of Mountaineering Scotland and Good Morning Scotland yesterday warning of very bad conditions on the hills this weekend and basically just saying, look, don't go up them. Please don't. It is extremely dangerous conditions up there today. The weather is still pretty ferocious. So
yeah, it's still pretty wild.
Yeah.
Mike Holcomb's been in touch about railways. He says there's lovely remains of a narrow-gauge railway line on the Duckle Moor in Clyde Muirshield Regional Park. It was called the Grouse Moor Line and built for the transport of grouse shooting parties and their equipment by Sir James Lithgow, the first baronet of shipbuilding fame. And it was undertaken to keep men employed after a drop in shipping orders after World War One. He goes on to say it's now derelict and slowly getting reclaimed by nature, but like your mentioned line, would make a fantastic tourist attraction if it was still operational. That's Senior Ranger Mike. I'm kind of with you, Mike, on that. There must be so many of these little projects across the country that would really deserve to come back.
Yeah. No, it's how it's actually done and who does it and where the money comes from and all that kind of thing. But, you know, to have that as a facility would be a wonderful thing. Last week in the programme, I read out an email from Corrie Cuthbertson. And she said, "Just heard you talking about sitting around your fire despite it being so warm. It made me wonder why you lit it. Haven't you heard of climate change? Shouldn't you be practicing what you preach? We all need to consider our actions, and you are well placed to educate too." Well, to be honest, that really got us thinking. Should I stop lighting the fire pit on Saturday mornings? Is it actually bad for the environment? Joining us now is someone who can explain a bit more, Dr. Jessica Slater, a researcher in air pollution and human health at the Stockholm Environment Institute in York. Good morning, Jessica. How are you?
Good morning, I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Not bad at all. So, ruin my day. Should I stop lighting the fire pit?
I'm afraid to say that fire pits and open burning of wood is bad for the environment. Not only does it contribute to climate change through emitting carbon dioxide and also other harmful pollutants which also warm the air, they're also a massive source of small particulate matter pollution, and these are tiny particles that we can breathe in and which will get into our lungs and sometimes into our bloodstream, and have been linked to a variety of health impacts, including lung cancer, heart disease, stroke, and aggravating asthma, which is a particular issue for small children. And I understand you're doing this open fire outdoors, but also in the UK we've seen a massive increase recently in the use of wood-burning stoves indoors for heating the home, which are really nice and very, very aesthetically pleasing and really make a very cozy home. But for now, these kind of stoves are a bigger contributor to our air pollution in the UK than traffic. They're the single biggest source of particulate matter of this kind of air pollution in the UK at the moment.
So what should we be using to cook? Mark uses it to cook bacon outside. My wood-burning stove, sadly, is my only source of heat at the moment. What's the alternative to outdoor cooking?
So I guess the alternative for outdoor cooking would be to use an electric or a gas kind of barbecue. They would be generally more efficient, produce less air pollution. Obviously, if you're wanting the heat as well, you would have to be looking at a heater or a patio heater. If you are going to use these wood burning open fires, there's various things that you can do to reduce the impact, the amount of emissions that are coming from them. I understand that you use wood from your small holding, and that's quite a sustainable way of collecting the wood. Making sure that the wood is dry massively will reduce the amount of emissions that are coming from the wood. And then the type of burning open fire stoves that you have can also kind of increase the efficiency that you're getting from in terms of heat and reduction in emissions as well. And very nice to sit around, and I know especially during lockdown that lots of people would gather with friends to sit around these open fires.
What I was trying to figure out was, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, wood is captured carbon in the first place. So it was the equation, you know, by burning that, I'm obviously releasing the carbon back into the atmosphere, but if I didn't burn it, the wood just rotted down, the carbon would be released anyway. All I'm doing is accelerating the process. Is that in and of itself bad?
Well, yes, that's a very interesting point, because in that case, you would say that the carbon dioxide emissions from the wood, because it's a renewable source technically, because the wood, like you said, in your case, is just going to rot into the ground. wood is renewable. The trees will grow again compared to gas, which is a non-renewable source. But in the case of a lot of cases, the wood will actually be felled to produce that, and it takes 20-30 years for the trees to regrow. So in terms of the climate impact, it's less clear cut, but definitely in terms of air pollution and producing these particulate matter, it's massively it's a massive source of air pollution.
So you've told them off about burning the wood. What about cooking?
She's depressing cooking. Me. That's what she's doing. She's depressing me.
Jessica's about to ruin your life. What about bacon then? Should Mark be cooking someone else apart from bacon?
I would probably say that the climate impact of meat is becoming more and more aware of it. Emissions of methane coming from the production of pigs, there's emissions of ammonia, which is another air pollutant. Plant-based alternatives are normally better. Just eating kind of vegetables, as unexciting as it sounds, if you were to cook bacon, then treat it as a treat. So maybe a Saturday morning thing and not an everyday thing that you're having in your diet. I feel like I've ruined your breakfast.
Yes, you have, but don't worry about that. That's your job. We've had a question just come in from a listener basically saying, what about smokeless coal?
Smokeless? I don't know that too much about it, so I wouldn't want to talk about it. I would assume that it's still, coal is still not very great for good for the environment. It is truly smokeless, and it doesn't have any emissions from the smoke. Probably much better for health, but I'm not a complete expert on smokeless coal, so I wouldn't want to talk too much about it.
The only day of the week when I put on the fire pit and cook bacon outside is on a Saturday morning when we do the programme. So I think you said that was okay.
Yes, and I would say that, well...
As a special treat, after all.
I think you're putting words in Jessica's mouth there.
Yes. No, there's definitely other ways that would be more environmentally friendly to be cooking and to cook different things. But I think there has been a massive increase in the use of these open fires and log burning stoves indoors as well. And I've spoken to members of the public before that have said they're concerned about neighbours having these open fires in their gardens, in their homes, and that they and their children are having to breathe in this smoke and they're not contributing to the pollution. So it's also worth considering other people that will be around if you are going to be having these open fires.
I don't know whether you heard, but we had a red weather warning last night, and I've got two trees down, three broken in half. I have tons of firewood waiting to get cut up at home. Jessica, you said none of the things I wanted you to say, but it's been a pleasure speaking to you anyway. Thank you very much.
And I hope you're not out with your open fire this morning.
Not in the slightest. Dr. Jessica Slater there.
I remember reading somewhere, a gardener saying that every garden bonfire or burning or incinerator is a failure of being a gardener. You should always compost it or recycle it. Never, ever burn it. I'm not practising what I preach. I'm just telling you.
I just like a bonfire. I know what you mean. I know what you mean. Anyway, cast your minds back to March. Let's change the subject. Cast your minds back to March 2020, and at a time when we were told, because of the global pandemic, we were restricted to just 1 hour of daily exercise.
And although this came as a major shock to most people, it's resulted in a renewed interest in walking by more folk. It's now much more common to meet people and go for a walk rather than go to a cafe these days. You know, walking dates, walking meetings.
But it also caused people to think about walking in new and creative ways, which is something that Professor Dee Hedden of Glasgow University is very interested in. She's heading up a study on walking during the pandemic called Walking Publics, Walking Arts. Helen and I went for a wander with her in Glasgow, and she described, this is an interesting idea, it's a concept of the proxy walk, something that, to be frank, we're quite accustomed to offering via the wonders of radio.
I mean, Alec Finlay, the artist, talks about this too, like the idea of if you can't walk, so you maybe lose your capacity for walking. So the idea, like the proxy walk, someone else doing a walk for you.
It's a bit like what we do, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah.
For the radio.
Yeah,
the radio
you just can transport folk,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
Through the words that you, and the pictures that you paint through your words, exactly, and the sounds that you've picked up, Helen. So you hear the water and you feel the water, really, don't you? There is a therapeutic benefit still of just encountering that imaginatively. One of the pictures that I've got in my bag is a picture that I drew. I'm going to share my artwork. Come on. This was a piece by an artist called Louise Ann Wilson, who's been thinking about the proxy walk, really, working with elderly women in the Lake District who, you know, no longer go out walking, but she uses her practice to support them to remember the walks. And she sort of changed that for the pandemic, and it was called Walks to Remember During a Pandemic. And it's a memory walk. And on the 29th of March, so 6 days after lockdown, she sent this email around or Facebook, whatever, and said, you know, would you like to participate in this project? But simply said, think of a place where you would like to be walking now, but you can't. One of my favourite walks is in Crinan. So I just sat at the kitchen table feeling very bereft, but then remembering this walk that I love so much, and spent, you wouldn't know it from looking at it, it's just a pencil, coloured pencil drawing of a tree plantation, really, and the sea, and there's an otter there if you look very carefully, the seashore. But it took me 2.5 hours, and for those 2.5 hours, I was there. I was in my kitchen flat in Glasgow thinking, oh my God, this lockdown, can't go out, don't know what to do. And then I found myself in my memory in Crinan, and it was so helpful. The walk itself takes 2.5 hours, so that is why I sat at the table drawing for 2.5 hours. And
wasn't a coincidence, that was a conscious decision.
It was a conscious decision. Yeah, and for 2.5 hours I didn't think about lockdown. There's this lovely poet called Jim Young who lives in the Gower Peninsula, and he has been doing pebble poems. Mm-hmm. And he just writes a little short poem on a pebble and he leaves them on the beach. And folk just can take them away if they want or leave them there. So this one is a little pebble that says, long wind, the golden grass bend, fare you well. Just little sort of haikus in a way there. The response to his stones during COVID have, you know, been quite significant. Folk have really loved that there's a little message from Jim every day left on the beach for them to find. But other artists use their work to sort of come to terms with their own sense of anxiety and bereavement and loss. This is a piece called Walk Boxes, and just to explain, there's about 12 little boxes, 10 centimetre sculptures, boxes, that this artist, Joe Delafons, has made. And each of these little boxes is chicken wire, and on each box she has captured a walk. So you can see on one box there's some moss that's embedded in it. On another walk there's like reeds.
Water.
You know. I guess it's a sort of document of a time. And she says, you know, these boxes in a way represent the containment that I felt and the restriction that I felt, but they also are rather beautiful in that they're telling that story of the months that, you know, we were in lockdown, and representing those in three-dimensional form. So they're sort of little sculptures. And then this is a Glasgow artist, Louise McVeigh, who makes ceramic graffiti. And so all around the West End, next time you're in Glasgow, look out for these little, beautiful, small ceramic objects, like a teapot, little gold teapot, or a gold ear, or a red heart with gold arteries into it. She just sticks these, you know, onto walls in public space, and you just come across them. So it's a bit like the Glasgow Banksy, really. It's like, it's a Louise McVeigh. You know, they've become a thing now. Like, where's Louise McVeigh's next work? And they're just hidden. She doesn't announce them. There's no map of them. They're just there. And that's another moment of beautiful imaginative intervention. You're on your walk to the shop and you come across a little piece of art that wasn't there the day before.
Just when you were speaking, I was thinking there that walking, you communicate from A to B.
Yeah.
This kind of art, this kind of graffiti, is communication too. Theatre is communication. During lockdown, it literally got very quiet. There were weeks and weeks and weeks when basically it was just birds and things. That's what you heard. In the same way that an audience goes quiet as the theatre goes dark and the lights come up on stage, the background noise went and it said, look, I'm talking to you here.
I think that's so well put. And I've not thought about that. You're right, but that's sort of quiet, so you're attentive, aren't you? You're focusing, you're attentive, you're really looking. So many artists use that to even prompt you to look harder and further. So now you're looking out for Louise McVeigh. Our environmental scene was very different. Lots of folk comment on how great it was that there was no noise of traffic, like it was so pleasant to be out. And in fact, I think that's the thing about walking, isn't it? How can we persuade, encourage governments to make walking that pleasant environment by reducing all those other polluting noises, I guess, literally polluting? We've asked the public what creative activities they undertook while they were walking. So someone created scent walks for themselves, so they would literally smell all the plants and flowers on whatever route they were, just take their time and sniff and inhale deeply. Other folks simply said, you know, we were bored with our walk, so we let our child decide where we were going, and they took us places we would never have thought to go, and we just found new places, so just letting the child be the guide. Someone else walked to Warsaw in their imagination, so added up the miles. off their daily walks and mapped it as if they'd walk. I mean, these are brilliant ways of inspiring and keeping folk walking during difficult times. So maybe that's also about the stage being cleared and they come onto the stage. They take the stage, they become the actor, they become the agent there. Partly because the environment has changed so much that it opens up room for us. I think loads of folk said that, didn't they? I'm not suggesting this is all diminishing the horrible impact of COVID. I don't mean that at all. But there were some things that folk found very beneficial, like slowing down. Like if you can't go beyond a mile, what do you find in your mile? If you can't walk beyond an hour, how do you make the hour count? You'll know this from theatre practice. If you put rules in, the rules become generative in a way. Like they become the thing that you have to work within, and then you know your creativity expands what you can do there. So some folk felt that in some ways, not to wish those limits on anyone, but the limits prompted them to be creative in response to that. I don't know whether you found that yourselves.
Professor D. Hedden there, and the honest answer is yes, we did. You know, it was amazing. It really forced you to be more creative. You can hear the full interview we did with D. on the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available now on BBC Sounds. D. also established something really interesting called the Walking Library, and she talks about that too. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElraith. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, you can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds or download the podcast from BBC Sounds.
We like hearing where you listen. You can email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Now, over the last couple of years, we've had some lovely emails relating to our podcasts. This week, we'd like to share this one from Shan, who writes in North Devon. She says, "Hello, you lovely people at Out of Doors. This March to May, I've rode the Atlantic from Tenerife to Antigua."
Wow!
Rode the Atlantic from Tenerife to Antigua. I took some downloaded Scotland Outdoors podcasts with me, as obviously there was no internet. I live in a small seaside village in North Devon, but had lived in Scotland for many years. My heart is still in Scotland, so your podcasts connect me with it and get me through many a night where sleep can be elusive. Knowing rowing the Atlantic would be hard at times, you know, reasonable,
yeah.
I took you with me. It was indeed hard mentally and emotionally, far more so than the obvious physical challenge. Your podcasts were a light relief and took me in my head somewhere easier just when I needed.
Yeah, she goes on to say, "Your last programme focused on walking and its efficacy in supporting health through connection." Sorry, I'm stumbling here because I've got a fading battery light. "In the most difficult times on the Atlantic crossing, I had to delve deep into a lifetime of support strategies, so I walked. During the long nighttime hours on the oars, I walked, leaving the front door of my flat and doing a familiar route around my village, looking at all the houses, recalling detail and the landmarks along the way. The process took me somewhere else in my head and relieved me of the fatigue and the tedium. I also formed a kind of mindful meditation, and by the end of each rowing shift, I would feel calm and ready to get on with chores before catching an hour of sleep before the next rowing shift. I will be forever appreciative of your podcast for assisting me through the Atlantic row and to walking as a mindful practice which gently engages the brain in a calming way. Incidentally, in a former life, I coordinated a large Walking for Health promotion initiative and saw firsthand how beneficial walking is to us all. Keep up the good work with your marvellous podcasts." And that's Shan.
When you say that you've got a red battery light warning, is that on the equipment or you?
No, this is on me. I've got a rechargeable battery. I've got three candles.
Candles are forks.
Candles are effectively useless. So my rechargeable, while you were reading that first bit, I was frantically looking for another battery to put into it. People don't appreciate what goes on here.
They don't realise what a consummate professional you are behind the scenes. Anyway, mystery bird guesses have been flooding in once again. These are incorrect ones. Tricia Hinton thought it was a red wing. Leslie from Edinburgh, also a red wing. Mandy and Richard and Devon, red wing. Alec Robertson, red wing. John from Langham, greenfinch. Lorna Blackcap, these are all so close. Fred Gordon and Armadale, mystery bird, field fare. Katie Cook, greenfinch. Alan Edinburgh, red wing. David Chadwick and Kaluk, stonechat. McCrae, crossbill. Pamela from Edinburgh, brambling. Keith in Hertfordshire, determined it's a snow bunting. And DB from Ullapool, waxwing. Excellent guesses, but none of them correct.
We thought we might struggle to get people to phone in with, you know, telephone masts down and signals gone and no power, but it's obviously people have got nothing else to do today apart from this. We have a captive audience. Let's embrace the email, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Just for the last time, let's have one more listen to that mystery bird sound. Thank you.
No, I honestly think that's quite a hard one. So, still 10 foot in your course. Time now to continue Ewan's first long-distance journey in his little electric car. Go, Noddy, go!
I'm back in Fort William. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I did stop off briefly at Ballahoolish to double check, and it's still not working. So I left Lough Creran with 45 miles range. I've travelled the 20 miles and I'm almost down to rock bottom. And frankly, the shine is beginning to wear off this. Bracken is glaring at me. I went into the app and it showed me that the machine was available. This is a fast charger just down by the supermarkets, if you know Fort William. Pressed start charge, selected the machine, and plugged it in. Your charging will begin in 60 seconds. Hey, happy days. And then it comes up. Charging not available at this charge point. So I tried it again. Charging not available at this charge point. I've got 3 hours drive to go, over an hour to the nearest charging point that I hope is going to work. So I tried to take the plug out to start again, and it's locked itself in. So I'm tethered to a lump of metal with a blue light, and nothing is happening. Long way from home, and yeah, I'm a bit hacked off. So once again, I'm going to phone for help. Okay, but 10 minutes later, a lovely chap, I think named Steve, was very patient. It would appear somebody's pressed the emergency stop button on the machine. So I've pulled that out and he's seen that. He said, yeah, that's working, I'll start it. But it won't start. Take the charger out, put it back, let's start the whole process again. Fantastic. It still won't come out of the car. It's locked in. And then Steve, being wonderfully patient, said, close the door, lock it and unlock it, and lock it and unlock it. And lo and behold, the cable came out, as if by magic. It's a steep learning curve. So I put it back. He rebooted it from wherever they are in the country. You put it into the machine first, then you press start, and lo and behold, a green light came on, and then another green light came on in the car, and I'm charging away. Only an hour to go to get a charge. But frankly, I'm relieved. So I'm going to take Bracken for a walk, relieve her pressure as well, and hopefully, well, we're not going to get the whole way, probably another charge to get back. But an hour and a half's time somewhere where I know there are lots of charges. All I want them to do is work. But it's been quite a trip so far. Maybe you can drive my car. It's now 7 o'clock. I left Lough Creran at 2. It's usually about a 4 hour journey, 3 3/4 hour journey. I've been at this for ages. But I am in Aberlour, which is a great thing because Aberlour is an EV friendly town. There's about 6 charging points. And what's even more special is they're free. And Murray doesn't have a limit on how long you can stay here. Back in Fort William, my car needed about an hour to charge it up to get me enough to get to here. But Highland Council, in their wisdom, have a 45-minute limit. After that, you're charged a penalty of £1 for every minute over that 45 minutes. And on top of that, they'll give you a parking ticket. Bless them. So a reasonably quick top-up here, then another hour drive home, and the whole epic saga will be over. But this bit is free, which almost makes up for it. But, yeah, thrown in at the deep end.
I think it's a good idea that you have a time limit on chargers, because otherwise folk just plug them in and go away for the day, you know, which or the night or whatever it is. But, you know, that sounds like a pretty complicated journey.
It was seriously complicated. I fully get the point. You don't want people leaving the charged in, but you should be able to charge your car up to an hour. And a pound a minute penalty, it seems. And you can't come back for 30 minutes. So I was faced with doing 45 minutes driving away and coming back for half an hour later and then going through the whole process again. I love the car, but, you know, it's a work in progress.
Yeah, very much so by the sound of it. Anyway, way before the pandemic, we became aware of a project by Huntley Development Trust to restore a bothy near Huntley for the local community. Like a lot of projects, the restoration was put on hold, but I'm pleased to say the Eco Bothy opened just last month. Now, it's situated at Green Miles, which is just off the E96, which is where I met coordinator Sandy Phillip, architect Jill Matthews, and the trust manager, Donald Boyd.
Huntley Development Trust bought the site back in 2014, and we bought it really with the aim of putting up a wind turbine on behalf of the community close to an existing set of seven wind turbines that had been here for about 10 years. As we were buying the site, we realised we're going to get 63 acres of, well, in some ways bleak Aberdeenshire hillside, but in other ways very attractive outdoor space with the turbine site. And that included a fairly run-down, deteriorating farmhouse, which we wanted to turn into space for the community.
Did the community have a say in this? Did they tell you, or did you tell them, by the way, you're getting this space?
We told them they were getting the wind turbine site, because that was the only way we thought we could keep the trust sustainable. You know, we're here for the long term. We have big ambitions for the town and the surrounding district, and the only way to make those real is to have some money to put into the game. Once we had bought the site, we then took the step to go to the community and said, right, OK, apart from that small area of the 63 acres, everything else is on the table. What would you like to see here? And that's when we got the first feedback from them.
Jill, describe this to me, because obviously you've tried to get this to fit into the landscape, into the sort of local vernacular.
Absolutely, yes. Well, you know, originally, well, when we took over in Green Myers, this was a 1.5-storey building. It had been extended really badly in the 1960s and 1970s.
That was often the case.
Absolutely, yes, with 8 different flat roofs that were all deteriorating. They were all in, you know, sort of very mouldy, very damp and things. It was a very poorly done extension and things, and the building really did not look like it belonged on site. You know, it really looked like something alien had landed. It would have been a possibility to demolish and start again, you know, but to us that wasn't the ethos of sustainability. Absolutely. So what we did instead was look at keeping the existing stone core of the building, which you can see here, the lime-washed part of the building is the old stone core. Back in the 1870s, when this building first appeared on the maps, it was just one room. It was just a single room, just like a little bothy. So that whole idea of, could we recreate that kind of bothy-type feel on the site by keeping the stone core, obviously improving the fabric of the building. It's so well insulated now. Put a new roof on, for that we went again with the rural aesthetic of the corrugated iron roof. And then we've sort of bookended almost the stone core with a couple of timber clad extensions and things that house the essential services for the building.
Sandy, you were tidying up earlier. Do you want to actually just show us inside?
Yeah.
What the facilities are?
So we're just going through the office here. So it's kind of at the front of the building. And this is just a wee office space that we can allow the public to use for like hot desking or any of the needs. It's got really fast Wi-Fi, so yeah, anything to have a desk or just a space to work in the on a nice kind of outdoor environment.
Of course, they've got to throw you out of it first again.
Oh, they do, for sure. Yeah, and going through into the main space, you can see on the kind of on the walls the bits of the original farmhouse that's kind of kept exposed, kind of brickwork there. And the main space is just can be used for anything really. There's a kitchen, all self-sufficient. The toilet's through there, and it's all heated through the ground source heat pump, so it's always nice and cosy.
It's a really, really handsome building, this. Let's head back outside again, because I just want to get some sort of
perspective of how it sits in the landscape. As attractive as the building is on the inside, it has to be said, you know, out here is still very, very exposed. But, you know, does it link in any other way? Because you're a fair distance from Huntley here, you're a fair distance from the forest. How is it all connected together?
Well, we've been really busy on the farm, you know, since we took it over and things. We've managed to plant over 6,500 native trees now, which are creating a really good shelter belt to the west and the southwest, which is one of the main wind directions up here. And we've also done a lot of work on connectivity. The A96 is great for people who have cars and things, but not so good for anybody who wants to arrive here recreationally. So we've developed a couple of paths, one leading back to Huntley itself to link in with a foot and a cycle path, and also with Forest and Land Scotland we've linked into Gartley Moor, which bounds us on the west here, and have given access to all the tracks and trails within the forest.
Yeah. And who predominantly, Sandy, is using this building at the moment?
So right now a regular user is a nursery, a local nursery called Wee Toots, and they use it about 4 days a week throughout the day. It's only just opened recently, so we're kind of getting more and more bookings coming through, but we've had a couple of uniform groups come in, the scouts and the guides, and it's been used to host AGMs for Snow Sports Scotland and the local Hillwalking and Rambling Association. There's also been some kind of wellness retreats, and using the space, they can use the inside and outside space.
Yeah. That's Sandy Phillip of the Huntley Eco Bothing. We also heard from Donald Boyd and Jill Andrews. It's a great resource, fantastic thing to have.
Yeah, we should have one here. The wind turbine must have been going stinger last night. I've got a red squirrel just arrived at the hazelnut supply. Imagine being a squirrel last night.
Well, funnily enough, I went out, I'm trying to remember what time it would have been, about 10 o'clock at night, and I was trying to work out where a particularly large branch had come from, and I shone the branch up in the trees, and there was a wood pigeon basically clinging on for its life. Now, the wind must have been blowing at that stage 50, 60 miles an hour, so I was very impressed that it could, to be honest. Anyway, talking of birds, mystery bird, yeah. Incorrect answers.
You know, this came against the wind just a nanosecond ago. Alison in Edinburgh is at a red wing. Ian, not in Tully Esselink because of my flight to Aberdeen was cancelled. Is it a blue throat? Jake and Bucky is at a red wing. Daniel is at a swallow. Linda from Stirling is at a linnet. Dave from Edinburgh is at a wheatear. Great programme as usual. Well, despite the odds. And Dave, is the bird a lapwing? No, it's not.
It's not, but incredibly, we've got four, count them, correct answers to this. Derek Listening in fourth got the right answer. Marlies McLean got the right answer. David Long at Spottiswood in the Scottish Borders got the right answer. And Catherine, listening in from windswept Worcestershire, also got the correct answer. And the correct answer is...
it's a redpoll. Let's hear a bit more. The tiny common redpoll, one of the smallest members of the finch family, weighs only as much as a £1 coin. Yet it survives the cold and the darkness of our winters, visiting from the tundra of the far north. During winter, some common redpolls tunnel into the snow to stay warm during the night. Tunnels that may be more than a foot long and 4 inches under the insulation of the snow. They feed on birch and alder seeds that are available throughout the winter, no matter how deep the snow, and the way they do it is clever. Redpolls are acrobats, feeding with ease on the smallest of branches, even hanging upside down to extract seeds from birch catkins. They shake the catkin vigorously, then drop to the snow to pick up the fallen seeds. And this bird typically eats 40% of its body weight in seeds every day to keep itself alive. And the redpoll's expanding esophagus allows it to store large numbers of seeds during rapid feeding. The bird then retires to the safety of the woodland and, while sheltering from the freezing winds, brings up the seeds one by one, cracking their shells and swallowing the nutritious kernel. In a land of extreme winter conditions, redpolls are survivors. But the redpoll was not always the delightful splash of winter colour that it is today. A long, long time ago, in the lands of the north, men, women and children suffered at the arrival of the winter. Cold, snow, ice, a desolate landscape, for this was in the days before the arrival of fire to see tribes through the season. At that time, all the fire in the world was in the possession of one massive polar bear, which lived in a cave many days' march to the north. Any attempts to get the precious element was met with a ferocious charge by the bear, leaving many injured, or even worse. As they contemplated their fate, spirits were cheered by the arrival of a small sparrow. The drab, mousy brown bird listened with sorrow to their woes, because at that time, both man and wildlife spoke the same language. He decided to help. The tribe gave him seeds of birch and alder from their precious reserves. Just before the sun scraped onto the horizon, the sparrow headed towards the pole star and the lair of the bear. For 2 days, he flew on and on northwards till he came to the mouth of the cave. There, in the darkness, was a dull red glow. The giant carnivore was sleeping soundly at the back of the cave, and cradled in his folded paws was the fire, the only fire in the world. Slowly, his tiny heart thumping, the sparrow crept forward. As he reached the bear, it opened one eye and growled. "Why have you come, little one?" he asked. "I've come to fight you for the fire," was the reply. The bear roared in laughter at the audacity of this tiny bird. For generations, the folk of the north had tried to obtain the spark, and many had suffered the ultimate sacrifice in the attempt. And here was a lone sparrow offering battle with the all-powerful guardian of the flame. Still chuckling, the beast eased itself back to sleep, to that long slumber of winter hibernation. But as he slept, the paws uncovered some red coals. Quickly, the bird grabbed the nearest, and in a trice was up and away, heading south once more. As he flew, the embers burnt against his breast, and his head was scorched by the heat. But onwards, onwards, he flew. When he arrived, the tribe quickly added the glowing coal to the stock of dry twigs and woods, and soon the life-giving blaze gave warmth and hope to those who had faced an uncertain future. And by that light of the new fire, the elders of the tribe noticed the rosy scorch patch on its breast and the raspberry red burn on its head, and called to the gods to reward this dull brown bird with the markings of pink and red forevermore. Pigmentation which marks out the red pole to this day and brings colour and joy to the depths of winter.
We've come to the end of this programme and accidentally discovered we've got a fire theme. How did that happen?
It was all meant. All meant, and I love the subtle, understated production that went into that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Just, well done, aware of it. Fantastic.
I'll be aware of it. David's been in touch saying, regarding the open fire debate, would it be worth investigating wood gasification stoves? It would be worth it, but we can't afford, well, I can't afford it. You know, we're having to buy our own bacon here. Apparently, wood gasification is a double-burning method where the smoke is burned. Believe principle even used to fuel vehicles during the war. That's an interesting idea. And this is from Andrea saying, great program as always after a noisy night, which it was. Interested in the conversation about your fire pit. Your guest mentioned a patio heater as one alternative, which used bottle gas, do they not? Yeah, apparently propane's actually cleaner than burning some types of, you know, sort of wet logs, something along those lines. Mm. But she also mentioned an electric patio heater, and I didn't think such things existed.
Yeah, yeah, they do exist. I've had one.
Anyway, of course you have. Of course
you
have.
As the light is emerging, I can see two trees in my garden that have fallen down, one up against the house and one up against the wall.
Yeah. Well, I'm not entirely certain what I'm going to go back to do, you know, this morning, but it's certainly there is a lot of firewood there waiting to be cut up. Sadly, that's all we've got time for. Don't forget the Scotland Outdoors podcast available today at noon, and look out for our midweek podcast. That'll be available on Wednesday at noon. Thanks for listening from all of the team.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.